right?
This is an interview with Joseph L. Hefferman for the Youngstown State University Democratic Party Project by Hugh G. Earnhardt at 815 Juanita Avenue, Youngstown, Ohio, on May 2nd, 1974 at 10:30 a.m.
I can tell you something about that that's significant, I think, yeah. And I'm going to get down here at that. To be candid and realistic, I should go into some of the religious condition. During that time, we had the Grand Dragon of State to Italy, Grand Dragon of Ohio, Clyde Osborne, a lawyer, a good friend of mine, went to school with his people there. He was the Grand Dragon. This was a nest of things, you see. But the thing is, they watched me as judge, and they had a big meeting as to put an opponent against me. And the fellow was in here as the Klan organizer. He got me a speech. I'd gone to Valparaiso University for a little while. And he said, I met him. He said, hey, where'd you go to school? I said, Valparaiso. He said, yeah. He said, how'd you happen to go there? I said, poor man, Harvard. I said, I didn't have much money. Well, he said, I went there too. And I tried to put a Klan candidate against me, but I made a speech about his old college friend. And he said, I've examined this man, Heffernan, and he said, one of our own couldn't be fair to us. He's never written a blemish on his record, this white president. He said, he leans over backwards. So they put in a phenomenal candidate, but I ran thousands of votes ahead of him. Well, then after I got in, the council was predominantly successful, and that was opposition to me, see? They were.
Why don't we start here and then go down and come down to that?
Yeah.
Okay? You want to do that first one?
Come that first.
Yeah, and then we'll work our way down through it.
Now, with that information, I'll go ahead, and if you think I'm getting off the line somewhere, we'll close it down and discuss it a little bit, but I think I should get on the depression.
Let's start here with number one. Yeah. Let's start up here.
On the depression, for instance, I made a trip to Europe just at that time with Mr. Grant. He was president of Citibank. My wife and I went over, and I went all over Europe. And I observed social conditions, Germany, England, France, all that. And I came back. The fellow picked me up for the Lions Club to make a speech. So I reviewed the conditions I had seen in Europe. And I announced that this depression was unlike anything in the history of the United States. I said, we talk about the depression of 1873. They were transitory. They were ephemeral, certainly. I said, this depression is going to last at least 10 years. I said, it's worldwide collapse. And I said, the people of Youngstown should accept that reality and not delude themselves that this is going to be a short suffering. I said, this is going to be long and severe. And I recommend that right now, the leaders of our community join the movement to provide a $1 million bond issue for relief. Mm-hmm. I went in the Youngstown Club today. Charlie Thomas, the steel man, came in. Oh, tear my ass off. Oh, Joe, he said, don't talk about those poor people that way. That's all wrong, Joe. Don't stir them up. I said, Mr. Tom, let me tell you. Said, it's you men who are wrong. I'm not wrong. It's you men who are wrong. You are so blind, you won't see the reality. You don't want to face social condition. All you want to do is make steel and make money. Now there's humanity in this community, and you are not thinking about the people. Now we all like you. He doesn't have the right. Talk to me because he knew me. Some of them wouldn't because they didn't know me. Well, Bobby, the minute I came looking at it, so I asked, the marriage borrowing trouble. The depression will be over before our bond is shut. Now, do I want to say something like that?
Sure. Fine. Okay.
Let's, yeah, all right. No.
Okay, let's do number one.
Well, all right. No.
What do you remember about your parents in early childhood?
All right. Go ahead now. I got to read my sheet, stenographer. This is stenographer.
He's a graduate student.
Yes. All right. All right. To begin my recollections of my boyhood and of my family background, it is my understanding that my paternal grandfather and grandmother with their family lived in County Tipperary, Ireland. I understand that they had a farm near the larger city of Clonmel and the smaller city of Cashel, which is near the historic rock of Cashel. Sometime in the early 1940s, they migrated with their family to the United States. My grandfather, in addition to being a farmer, was also an expert with horses, as many Irish men are. I have always understood that they landed at New York City, and his first work was on the Croton, the building of the Croton Reservoir, where he had charge of teams of horses and dump trucks in the excavation. After they were there for some time, they began to move west with the railroads, and he did similar work along the right-of-way of the Erie Railroad. In that way, they first reached Hubbard, Ohio. They stayed there for several years. And my father had charge of the mules and horses which were used in the operation of the Andrews Hitchcock blast furnace at Hubbard. Around the blast furnace and the mills in those days, they usually had men with horses who did such work as hauling the ashes away from the furnace to an area near the mill and near the city where they built up a dump with ashes. That was my grandfather's work at Youngstown. Coming up to the Civil War, he had accumulated what might be called a small competence. That's the expression that they used in that day. It might say a modest wealth. And he came to Youngstown. As I recall, he had five children. My father, I think, was the oldest. And there was a brother who went west and was lost in the confusion of that period. One sister stayed in Youngstown and was married here, had a family here. This sister married a man who was superintendent of the Steinway factory at Long Island City, New York. And she and her family lived in Long Island. Another sister married a man who was in a Youngstown, and they took up a homestead in the state of Missouri at the small village which is called Camp Branch, near Kansas City, Missouri. While they were still at Hubbard, my father grew up, and during his teens, he learned with his father to be a horse shoer and a mule shoer. And afterwards, when I looked at his arms, they were so muscular and he was so strong that I was always reminded of the village blacksmith and the Pope. At the time of the Civil War, Youngstown was beginning to grow from a village to a city. My grandfather decided it would be wise to move to Youngstown. So he came here and he put a plot of ground on the lower end of Foster Street, which extended from what is now Arlington Avenue, and then was called Thomas Street, northward or down a slight hill to Rand Avenue. He built there a large frame house, which was his home. He built several houses on the other lots, and that gave him an income, so that he was living in fairly comfortable circumstances. There was a barn on the back of the lot, and he had a garden. They had a flock of chickens, and they had two Jersey cows. My father, when he came to Youngstown, gravitated towards the iron mills, and he became a peddler. The iron mills at Youngstown were then just developing. They were the predecessors of the great steel mills that are now here. And the peddling trade is extinct. They try to develop the manual peddling into machine peddling. But the old peddler said that a machine could never peddle iron. And their prophecy was true. They discovered that they could not peddle iron with a machine. And in the process of development from the we might say the primitive puddling mills of, where the iron was made into the steel industry, the puddlers were crowded out, and it's likely to say that there's not a man living in America who was a practical puddler in the early days. That is a decided social change in our community and in many other communities throughout the country. The men of the iron mill were a distinct species. There were as lawyers as sweet and nurse. There were no other men quite similar to them. They had a life of their own. Most of them came from the British Isles. They learned their trade in England in what is now called the Black Country or the Midland, around the town of Wolverhampton and such cities. They were of Welsh, and there were Mills too in Wales. So some of them learned their trade in Wales. I think there were no mills in Scotland and no mills in Ireland, but some of the Scots went down to the mills, and a great many of the Irish went over to work in the mills of England. That's where those men learned their trade, and they had different classifications of position. We had the puddlers, and after the men made the, put the puddle, the iron through the puddle furnace. It went to another, it went through what is called a squeezer. When it left the furnace, it was a large round ball. And that ball went through a rotary squeezer to bring out the last of the impurity. There was a hater. I'm not clear as to the work of the hater, but evidently he reheated the iron after it went through the furnace. And then in the top grade, we had the men who were called the rollers. They took the iron that the peddlers had made and passed it through the rolls so that it took the shape which made the final product to be distributed on the market. That shape was made by the shape of the road. And the roller had to know how to shape his roads and how to fit so that he could make iron of a large size or a very small size. And in some ways, it is fantastic to think of the rollers as the lords of labor at that time. They had wages which then were so high that it was almost unbelievable. A peddler had a substantial wage. He was well paid for his work on a tonnage basis. And the heater had a fairly substantial weight. But the rollers often were paid $50 and $100 a day, which on a comparison with money today would sound like $500. I could never quite understand why the owners paid them. It seems that they all had contracts, and they became, most of them became wealthy. And sometimes we had a roller who would turn his assistant, put his assistant in charge of the mill, and he'd go off to Europe for a vacation. Now, that is tracing, in a way, the development of the early iron business. When the steel came into Youngstown, the steel mills came to Youngstown, the iron mills began to fade, and soon the last of them disappeared. On my maternal side, my grandfather was born and reared in County Clare, Ireland. My grandmother was born and reared at Glasgow, Scotland, in the suburb or village of Paisley. He decided to migrate to the United States. He was a stonemason. My grandmother, at the same time, with a lustreware teapot and a pair of camels, candles, gal sticks, and a paisley shawl, and a little Scotch bonnet, also migrated. The tradition that I have always had brought them together on shipboard. And they were married as soon as they landed. He found work as a stonemason. And they came into Ohio at Steubenville. So that my mother was born at Steubenville, while my father was born in Ireland. When I got to Steubenville, he found work as a stonemason contractor, principally with the railroads and sometimes with the highway department of the state. He built stone culverts and stone bridges, all on the railroads of northeastern Ohio, and on some of the highways. And I think that some of those culverts and bridges are probably standing today. In following his work on the railroad, he advanced from Steubenville up through the state until they arrived at Niles in Trumbull County. Evidently, they were at Niles for several years. My mother went to school in Niles. At that time, there were two groups of people living at Niles. One was Irish, and the other was Welsh. And there was hardly anybody in Niles at that time who did not belong to the Irish group or to the Welsh. William McKinley was born at Niles. My mother used to talk as if she had known him when they were young. She went to school at Niles, and she often talked to us about a canal that came down through Niles, probably from Cleveland to Youngstown. And she had the experience at one time of getting in serious trouble because she and several girls opened the lock on the canal, and when the boats came, there was no water for them to come to us. She often talked to us about the old families who were then at Niles and the ones that she knew when she was a girl. So I've always had an intimate association with Niles, and the people up there have always regarded me almost as if I had a hometown boy. Now, after they were at Niles for some time, they moved to Youngstown. I don't know just why, except transcription accurately in the subsection of Smoky Hollow, which was called Bottle Hill. I could understand the origin of Smoky Hollow, the name, because the Valley Mill was on the east side of the river at the street which is called Valley Street. That's an iron mill. That's where the peddlers and the heaters and the rollers were. It was the center of the neighborhood, the means of making a living for all the people there. The subsection of Smoky Hollow, called Bottle Hill, was farther north than the main part of Smoky Hollow. I may be wrong in this conclusion, but I always had my own origin of the name Bottle Hill. In those days, the mill men had a social practice of assembling on Saturday night at the favorite taverns. And they all had a series of drinks. And sometimes they had some very pleasant and enjoyable fights because they were all vigorous men. When they went home, they quite often took with them a bottle of whiskey. They could get a half pint for 20 cents and a pint for 40 cents and a drink for 10 cents. So it's been my conclusion that as the mill men went home on Saturday night, they sometimes finished up the bottle that they had meant to take home and pitched it in the bushes alongside the street. And then the boys of the neighborhood developed a business. They collected bottles, and they took those bottles to the saloon keeper, and they got 1 penny for a half pint and 2 pennies for a pint. And I think that that practice of the men in discarding their bottles and of the alert young men who developed the business of collecting the bottles, we have the origin of the name Bottle Hill. My maternal parents settled at the corner of what became Willow Street and McGuffey Street, which is now directly under the McGuffey Street Bridge. My grandmother was both thrifty and shrewd in business. My grandfather was a good mason contractor, and he was always occupied and was well esteemed. But my grandmother was the dominant member of the family. His name was Flynn, James L. Flynn, and her name was Jane Dunlap. So they settled at the corner of Willow and McGuffey Street, and they built a large two-story frame building. The first floor was a combined grocery store and The second floor was the living quarters. They had a large loft extending along northward, southward in Willow Street. And that was a garden. They also had a barn on it and had a horse. But I'm not sure that they had cows. As my father did, my grandfather did on Foster Street, they bought a plot of ground running southward on the west side of Willow. My grandmother handled the money in the family. And one of the precepts that she gave me was, Letty, take care of the pence, and the shilling will take care of itself. She was extremely thrifty, and she was provident. So on that plot of ground, she built a string of houses extending southward on the west side of Willow Street. And those houses, all of them up to about 10, rented for $10 a month. And one small house, might call it a cottage or a cabin, rented $5 a month. With that accumulation of money and her handling it judiciously, they became fairly wealthy. So that she had her own horse and surrey, even with the fringe on top. And on a particular day in the year, she would hitch up the horse to the surrey, and she would drive around Youngstown, making social calls on all her Scotch relatives and the people from Scotland that she called her townies. Maya.
What year? About what year is this?
They came here.
No. When they had the grocery store.
Oh. I think that they, my maternal grandparents, came to Youngstown about 1870. And I think that my paternal grandparents came to Youngstown at the time of the Civil War. I rather base that on the idea of the marriage of my father and mother, which was sometime in the early 70s. So it must have been that my grandparents were here and established in 1870, or perhaps a little early. Youngstown was just emerging from the village into a town. I have an impression, but I'm not sure, that my maternal grandfather, James Flynn, had a little prominence on the East Side as a political leader. Whether he was a Democrat or a Republican, I don't know. But I assume that he was a Democrat. He continued his work as a Mason. A large part of it was building stone walls for Salem, which of course we do not do today. And I think that in many of the houses on the East Side, the old houses, those that are 100 years old, and there are some, you still find the stone walls that were built by my grandfather. They had several children, let's see. They had at least seven children, I think. One died and six were left. My mother was Rose Ann Flynn. One of my aunts was Sarah Ann Flynn. Another aunt was Mary Ann Flynn. Another aunt was Marcus Flynn. And the two surviving brothers were Peter J. Flynn and John K. Flynn. What their marriage? It might be worth noting that Peter J. Flynn and John K. Flynn went west in the early days. Peter J. Flynn was first, according to my recollection, at Anaconda, Montana. That is the site of the great copper smelter. And he there built, he had become a bricklayer. He built there the stack carrying the fumes from the Marcus Daly Anaconda Company smelter. He built there the highest smokestack in the world. He became a very high-class building contractor. J.K. Flynn also became a building contractor. They both moved to Portland, Oregon. And the Union Station, Portland, was still there, I think. And the hospitals and schools of an early day were built by my uncle, Peter J. Flynn, and my uncle, John K. Flynn. And a number of the large buildings in San Francisco were built by those two uncles. And as I understand, the lighthouses in the Hawaiian Islands were built by them. That parish seemed to have a wandering streak, and they spread over the country so that all of the children of my maternal parents left Youngstown. No, that's right. My mother, of course, stayed here. And one aunt, Sarah Ann, married Daniel Griffin. And Daniel Griffin continued here, and he was a wholesale liquor dealer, and he became fairly wealthy. One of his sons afterwards was well known in Youngstown as the treasurer and vice president of the city bank. when he became advanced in years, he married and went to California. Another son was Reverend Patrick Griffin, who for a number of years was stationed at St. Patrick's Church in Youngstown. Now, I don't want to take up too much time on my own family. I'd like to try to give a few of Youngstown as a community.
Before you do that, what did you do as a child? As you were growing up.
Yeah. As a child.
Did you have a job?
That one is a personal interest. I have a real interest. I'll digress from the community for a moment and tie in a little of my own biography. I was born on East Boardman Street, February 8, 1887. So that I'm now 87 years of age. As I give this interview. The house was at the lower end of East Boardman Street. And the reason I was born there is that my father married Roseanne Flynn. And they built there a typical home of a man working in the iron mill. It had four rooms, built in two stories, with one room projecting on the back for the kitchen. The iron mill, which was called the Brown Funnel Mill, was along the bank of the river just south of Boardman and Front Street. It appears that the reason my father and mother built that house there was so it would be close to the mill, and he could walk from his home, and in 5 minutes he would be at his pedal furnace in the Brown Bottle Mill. I once had a picture of that house, but I don't know where it is. And yesterday, a lawyer friend of mine with whom I was visiting drove me down through that neighborhood. I expected that the house would have disappeared. But I was rather horrified to find that it was buried on my father's side, died. Because of his death, my parents and the 6 children at that time moved to the Foster Street residence. That was done so that we could be with Granny Helfer. Granny Heffernan was the type who had been perfect in a novel about iron. She was tall and swarthy. Her face That's as far as delicious. Raw, thick as cream. She had a superb talent for telling fairy tales. And in the evening, we children would gather around her rocking chair. And she'd say, Granny, tell us a story. Whether she made them up herself or whether she had learned them in Ireland, I don't know. But she would spend hours telling us fairy stories and other stories. And finally the session would end when my mother would indignantly say, Granny, Granny, stop filling their heads. And then Granny would have to call off her performance and retire. I was then 3 or 4 years of age. In the meantime, my maternal grandfather had died, and my grandmother, Flynn, asked us to come and live with her. So we bundled together and moved down with Granny Flynn. She was not as congenial as Granny Heffernan, and it was difficult to stay with. But we stayed until a big event in the history of Youngstown caused us to change. Incidentally, the first school I attended was what we called the Little Brick School on Covington Street. It took children before they were school age in the nature of a kindergarten. And the teacher there was Carrie Kirk, a very fine character of the early days, who lived out in a big home on the point of McGuffey Street, which is near Scienceville. So after we went with Granny, Grandma Flynn for a while, the panic of 83 came. That was my first experience with what we call hard times. And I think that it entirely colored my life. So when the Great Depression came at the time I was mayor, I was actuated by my personal memory of the panic of 93 and the hard times that had struck the working people of Youngstown. Because the mills were closed down, and men who worked in them could find no work of any kind, my father and mother likely threw the thrift inherited by my mother, accumulated rather substantial amount of money. They decided to buy a farm and to live there at least till the hard times passed. So they bought a farm out on what we might call Oak Street Extension. That's the part of Oak Street that passes Lincoln's Park and goes on out towards the Pennsylvania line and New Bedford. Our farm was at the junction of Jacobs Road and Oak Street Extension, or Oak Street Road. Jacobs Road in our time was called Jackson's Lane. because the big farm at the corner of the lane and Oak Street was owned and operated by Joseph Jackson. Joseph Jackson was one of the real pioneers in the district. Whether or not he came with John Young, he certainly came with Lee Dave. And he acquired that large farm. As I remember, he was the Democratic leader in that part of the county. And I feel sure that for some years he served as county commissioner. He had two sons. One son was named Johnny Jackson. And he continued to live on the farm. The other son was called Lamar Jackson. His name was Lamar Sidney Jackson, I think. S-D-L were his initials. He became a lawyer. He became a famous orator. He became a Republican leader. And he became prosecuting attorney. Johnny Jackson had at least two children. One of them was named Lamar Jackson. He is now the head on the big law firm, which in my mind is called Harrington & Ford Hine Huxley. He has been there all of his life as a lawyer, and I think is now at the head of the firm. The other boy is equally in well known, or perhaps better known. He served in the United States, in the State Senate for several terms. And he is conspicuous in Youngstown as Clingan Jackson, the political editor of the Vindicator. When we got out to the farm in Coatesville, I had then reached a school age.